Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tuesday marked 1 month since the deadly shooting in Sacramento that killed 6 people and injured a dozen more. Coincidence or not, on that same day, the Sacramento County District Attorney also announced murder charges against 3 people in connection to the deadly shooting. And both police and the DA's office believe this was a dispute between rival gangs. CAP Radio News editor Chris Hooks has been following the story closely and joins us with the latest on the investigation. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Vicky, how's it going?
All right, Chris, walk us through who is facing charges and what exactly for.
Yeah, so all 3 suspects, you have DeAndre Martin, Smiley Martin, and Matula Payton. They're all facing multiple murder charges in the deaths of 3 women who were killed that night. Jontea Alexander, Melinda Davis, and Yami Martinez Andrade. Smiley Martin is also facing charges of being a convicted felon in possession of a handgun, as well as unlawful possession of a machine gun. DeAndre and Matula are also facing additional charge of being convicted felon in possession as well. District Attorney Amory Schubert said her office filed the charges along with special circumstances that the 3 suspects allegedly committed multiple murders. So that filing could lead to the death penalty if Schubert's office decides to pursue that.
One of the suspects, Matula Payton, who is still a fugitive, is at large, is facing additional charges related to EDD. Can you walk us through what investigators discovered?
Right. So I'm sure we all remember when the state announced there was billions of dollars in unemployment fraud. So Schubert alleges that Matula Payton defrauded the state for about $45,000 while he was in prison in 2020. So he's also facing 3 counts of EDD fraud for that.
Did they have any update on the status or potential whereabouts of Payton?
No. He's, like you said, a fugitive still at large.
There were a total of 6 people who died, Chris, but why are there only murder charges filed for 3 of the victims and not all 6?
Right. So the other 3 killed were Devazia Turner, Sergio Harris, and Joshua Hoya Lachezi. Schubert's office didn't charge Payton or the Martin brothers with their deaths because their relation to the shooting. They say Turner was one of the shooters. Hoya Lachezi was friends with the Martin brothers. And Harris had gunshot residue on his hand. So it seems that he was also one of the shooters in the shootout. So essentially, they say it's difficult to charge someone in a victim's death if the victim was a participant in the crime.
And how do they know that?
Well, there's a lot of video and photographic evidence and court documents. The police department really put sort of a minute by minute and even photo frame by frame of what happened that night, just based on videos and photos from the area. So.
Yeah, given that extensive amount of evidence, do we know if any of the people who were injured are they considered connected to the shooting, or were all 12 innocent bystanders?
As of now, the other 12 appear to be innocent bystanders, just caught in the crossfire of a rival shootout. So.
Yeah, I want to go back to that night because obviously it was a chaotic situation. Developments were rapidly fluid. So I want to clarify one thing because there seems to be some confusion about this. The first cell phone video that surfaced that Sunday morning showed a fight. At this point, have investigators said or indicated that that fight was part of the shooting, or was it a separate isolated incident?
As far as I know, the fight was just separate from the shooting. It just happened to be nearby. We also have to remember there were 2 or 3 concerts that night in the same area. So there were a lot of things going on. So it does appear that it was a separate fight from the shooting itself.
Right. And this is happening just as bars are about to let out on a right. really busy Saturday night, obviously going into early Sunday morning. Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester was also at Tuesday's press conference with District Attorney Schubert. What is she saying about the violence that's unfolding in the city? Because we've been having conversations, even though this one received the most attention, more homicides have continued within city limits.
Yeah, I mean, well, she's really saying the same thing that community leaders have been saying since the shooting, that the reason this was so shocking to people was because of where it happened, that it happened in downtown Sacramento in this very, very busy and happening nightlife district. But like it's so is a mass shooting of this magnitude normal in Sacramento? Obviously not. But it's sort of violence. It's not shocking to everyone in the city because some of them know it all too well. I think you should have the bite of what Lester said.
Guns and gangs are fully entrenched in this. Addressing urban violence needs to be a community effort and requires partnerships at every level. I know that none of us can create public safety alone, not the police department, not the city, and not even the best intentioned community-based organizations. We all have to work on reducing violent crime together.
And I want to highlight something that she said and connected to a guest that you had on Insight on Tuesday, Mervin Brookins of Brother to Brother. So at the top of that clip, she mentions that gangs are fully entrenched in this, right? Now, the other day, just hours before Lester said that at the press conference, Brookins, who spoke to you on Tuesday, he talked about how people can hear that word gang. And as soon as that word gang is attached to the shooting, people completely just begin to dismiss it as the shooting because it's something that they don't see as it being affecting their own backyard. And it sort of erases the shock. And I think you sort of see that happening throughout the city now is people have forgotten, not necessarily forgotten that this has happened, but aren't necessarily looking at it as this mass shooting, which it was.
Right. And what Brookins was saying that essentially it allows people to kind of justify what happened and the harm in that, because Brother to Brother is a nonprofit. They're a community organization that mentors at-risk youth. So the goal for Mervin, our prevention services, to give youth alternatives as opposed to this lifestyle. And they intervene in gang intervention and gang prevention as well. And when we were having that discussion with Mervin on Tuesday, I mean, we had been talking about the fact that Sacramento has been doing, before the pandemic, a good job of containing youth violence. There were zero youth deaths by gun violence in 2018 and 2019 in the city of Sacramento. Can you talk about what seems to have happened or changed over the last 2 years?
I mean, short answer, the pandemic. Like you said, we went a long time without youth homicide. We went 28 months without youth homicide. Then comes the pandemic, which shuts everything down. It shuts down schools. It shuts down programs. It shuts down all these things that keeps teens and young adults busy. So, and then you have every crisis that we had before the pandemic just worsened. You have a worsened housing crisis. You have job loss issues. You have rising cost of living. And with all of that, everything just becomes really about survival for many folks.
We've heard time and time again about how crucial those youth pop-ups were, and I know they have continued in some sense throughout the pandemic, but a lot of them were virtual. But now there's this call for a ballot measure, or there is a ballot measure that's coming up that would keep money flowing to youth programs. So what would that exactly do, and who's backing it?
Yeah, so you have Mayor Daryl Steinberg, City Council members Jay Chenier, and my Vang are working with the nonprofit SAC Kids First to create the ballot proposal. Right now, details are sort of scarce on what the ballot measure would have. But for now, what I know is that it would create a permanent funding source for youth programs in the city. Right now, a lot of that money is spent on youth programs is based on grant funding and one-time funding. For example, this year alone, I think about $6 million in youth program comes from the COVID funding from the federal government. I've been told that this measure could be similar to Measure G, which residents voted down in 2020. That measure would have given roughly $12 million in permanent funding, but it also would have been attached to there being a surplus in the budget. So it could have also fluctuated.
Chris, thank you so much for updating us on this.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Vicky.
Chris Hooks is Cap Radio's news editor. Up next, Senator Alex Padilla joins us in the aftermath of a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that would overturn Roe versus Wade. USC has also reached another settlement with dozens of former students alleging sexual abuse by a university men's health doctor. We'll speak with the attorneys. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is mounting a fight for abortion rights following a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade. At our nation's capital, Democratic lawmakers are crafting their own response to ensure that the essence of the nearly 50-year-old landmark decision remains intact, a person's right to choose. California Senator Alex Padilla is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and spoke with us this morning about co-sponsoring a bill that would guarantee access and the right to provide abortion services across the United States.
Senator Padilla, what will the Women's Health Protection Act accomplish if it's passed and it's signed into law?
The Women's Health Protection Act, if passed and signed into law, will codify into federal law the protection of a woman's right to choose, women's access, not just to abortion, but to all reproductive health services. And we know how critically urgent it now is. For some time now, people have feared the potential of the rollback of Roe v. Wade. Well, given the draft Supreme Court ruling that the world learned about this week, it's no longer a potential threat. It's an imminent threat. So I do believe that Congress needs to act urgently to protect a woman's right to choose.
But Senator, politically, Congress and particularly the Senate is razor thin, even with Vice President Kamala Harris as a tiebreaker. Realistically, in what scenario do you see this passing?
Look, I think it remains challenging. It has been challenging, but I would also like to think that there was a significant shift in the debate and the position of senators that may be on the fence, because the threat is no longer potential or theoretical. It is imminent. There's a clear and present danger. And I think that clear and present danger may move some senators to not only do what's right, to uphold what has been considered settled law for nearly 50 years, that it is up to a woman or a woman and her doctor to decide what is best for her health and what happens to her body. And in that case, protect these fundamental rights for women across the country and not have unequal protection, you know, where women have certain rights based on what state they live. That's absolutely wrong.
What conversations have you been having with lawmakers across party lines that gives you that optimism that this could actually become a reality, that this act could become law?
Look, I always have to be hopeful and optimism that the right thing will always prevail, but I'm not naive to think that it's going to be easy. And so the conversations have been ongoing and intense from Monday evening when the draft ruling was unveiled, obviously through Tuesday, Wednesday of this week, up until and including Judiciary Committee this morning, where there's impassioned debate on both sides of the aisle. But it's too important. Most of the American public supports the protections provided by Roe v. Wade. Here's what else is going on. If you read the draft opinion, as threatening as it is for reproductive rights, the rationale that the majority of the Supreme Court justices seem to be using to roll back these protections also jeopardizes so many other fundamental rights. If you support interracial marriage, for example, for people who love each other and, you know, want to spend the rest of their lives together, that could be undermined by the same rationale. Access to contraception, other civil rights. We've already seen what the Supreme Court has done to voting rights in recent years. This is a very dangerous path we're on. Mm-hmm.
What conversations are you having with Republican lawmakers, and are there specific lawmakers that make you more hopeful or optimistic?
Look, there's a lot of Republican lawmakers who just are clearly not going to come around. Oddly enough, a lot of Republican lawmakers who don't want to talk about Roe v. Wade or access to reproductive health care services. And they're trying to hide behind the dynamics of, oh, this was an unlawful leak and it needs to be investigated. Well, yeah, if that's the case, then Chief Justice Roberts has already called for an inquiry or an investigation. But don't let it distract from the substance here. A woman's right to choose is now in full jeopardy. There's a clear and present danger. And you have other dynamics work here, including the Supreme Court, the confirmation process for Supreme Court justices. When Senator Collins from Maine says that if what she read in the draft ruling hold, it's inconsistent with conversations she's had with current justices that were nominees once upon a time seeking her support for confirmation, that should be equally alarming and disturbing as well.
Yeah, and this applies to not only women, but individuals of all gender identities when it comes to reproductive rights. I want to get to Chief Justice Roberts. He called the leak a singular and egregious breach of trust. Do you see it that way, given that your party and Democratic states, including California, now have the opportunity to get a head start to fight the ramifications of this potential Supreme Court decision?
A couple of things. If Chief Justice Roberts wants to talk about a breach of trust, I read into that a concern about public confidence or faith in the judiciary, including the Supreme Court. It's a dynamic that I raised in the recent confirmation hearings for soon-to-be Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. But sadly, disappointingly, the two main stories that have come out of the Supreme Court in recent months are the text messages from Justice Thomas's wife, letting us know her involvement, intimate involvement in the January 6th insurrection of last year. That should be concerning. Obviously, the substance and rationale of this draft ruling on Roe v. Wade, overturning Roe v. Wade, that should be alarming and concerning. If ever there was a time to bring about ethics reform and ensure oversight and accountability for justices that do not act professionally or appropriately, now is that time. Now, that being said, at a state level, first of all, I want to applaud Governor Newsom and the legislature for immediately thinking of what can we do to enshrine a woman's right to choose and access to reproductive health services for all in the state of California. So I fully support the effort to place a constitutional amendment on the ballot and will support that effort. But from a national perspective, it shouldn't be the case that women and others only enjoy certain rights, certain access to healthcare services based on what state you live. Everybody across the country deserves that equal protection.
Finally, as you mentioned, the majority of public opinion across party lines supports some version of Roe versus Wade, some version of abortion rights for individuals. Do you believe that this leaked draft opinion will mobilize more voters in the midterms and ultimately help the Democratic Party?
Look, I certainly hope that this serves as a motivator for people to get out and vote in November. Anybody who wonders if it makes a difference who's in the majority in Congress, particularly in the United States Senate, this should answer the question. If you want an idea, a glimpse of what a Republican majority United States Senate would mean, the reversal of Roe v. Wade is just the beginning. Take that to heart. Get out and vote.
What do you say to individuals who aren't in support of abortion, that actually approve of the leaked opinion if it actually becomes an official decision by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, look, if you disagree with abortion, that is your personal right, but it's exactly that. It's a personal decision for other women who need access to reproductive health services. That's their personal decision. And that personal choice is at high risk of being taken away. It seems imminent, and Congress needs to act to enshrine those rights in federal statute.
Thank you so much, Senator Padilla, for making the time.
Thank you.
And that is my conversation with Senator Alex Padilla about co-sponsoring the Women's Health Protection Act, which would guarantee access and the right to provide abortion services for all gender identities in the United States. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. The University of Southern California has reached a settlement in a sexual abuse lawsuit filed by former students against a campus doctor. If this sounds familiar, it's because it is. This is the second time USC has reached a settlement involving sexual abuse by a university physician. The first involved a former USC gynecologist. This time, the doctor is a former men's health physician. 80 former students filed the civil lawsuit. The overwhelming majority identify as male and LGBTQ+. However, there is a big difference between the two settlements. While the university disclosed a $1 billion settlement for the gynecologist and issued a formal apology, this recent settlement remains confidential, and both USC and the physician deny wrongdoing. Michaela Kellogg and Kelly Van Aken are the attorneys who filed the original lawsuit and join us now. Welcome, Michaela and Kelly.
Good morning. Thanks so much. Good morning. Thanks so much for having us.
Good morning. Michaela, starting with you, this isn't the first time a university doctor accused of sexual abuse has been accused of sexual abuse during exams. I mean, just the top of my head are two at USC, one at UCLA, Olympic gymnast physician Larry Nassar at Michigan State. But really what sets this apart are the students who identify as male and gay or bisexual. This lawsuit dismantles kind of that knee-jerk assumption of who a sexual abuse victim is.
That's right, Vicki. And I think that's such an important thing to remember, that unfortunately, sexual abuse can happen to anyone and does happen to anyone. And there's really no population that's immune from the fact that sexual abuse can happen. And I think that the 80 men in our case who came forward, most of whom, as you said, identify as LGBTQ+, I think it demonstrates that here.
Kelly, this is a legal journey more than 3 years in the making, 80 former students, but you started with just one. What message does that send?
I think it sends that that this is something that happens. It starts typically with one person or with a small group of people. And then people learn that they're not alone. And that encourages other people to come forward and share their voices and their stories. Because sometimes this can be a really isolating experience. These people have gone through trauma. They have repressed feelings about what has happened to them. But hearing the stories of others, I think, really helps to encourage people to share their own stories.
Do you think previous lawsuits, you know, I just ran through Michigan State, you know, one at the university at USC, did that help encourage or empower people to come forward?
Absolutely. I mean, hearing the stories of the women who were impacted by former gynecologist George Tyndall certainly encouraged the first plaintiff in our case to come forward, realizing and reflecting on his own visit with Dr. Kelly in the context of the Student Health Center at USC and having that other doctor who had been accused of misconduct kind of rang a bell for him.
Yeah. Michaela, we're talking about a violation that is just so extremely personal, but when talking with your clients, was there a commonality in really not knowing how to navigate what was taking place within a doctor's office or even struggling to realize that what felt wrong was wrong? Because this is a setting in which we're taught to not only trust, but to also obey.
Absolutely, Vicki. I think especially in a patient-physician setting, there is a power dynamic in which the physician has a lot more power than the patient. And then when you add the factor that it's at a student health center with people who are in their late teens and early 20s who have not had the experience of going to the doctor on their own without a parent present, who may not have the knowledge about the boundaries and what to expect, it really creates an environment in which a perpetrator can take advantage of the individual patient or student. And it breeds misconduct, unfortunately. And that's really why institutions have to pay attention. They have to have proper oversight. They have to do proper vetting. They have to have continued reviews. And it's so important in order to prevent misconduct from occurring.
Given that the both of you filed this original lawsuit more than 3 years ago, I want to ask both of you, how do you reflect on that time. It's been more than 3 years in the making, reaching this undisclosed settlement. Michaela?
Sure. Yeah, it's been a long journey. It's been a long journey for us, but mostly for our clients who have really had to go through a lot and reliving the trauma, telling over and over again what happened to them. And, you know, being subject to doubt and scrutiny. A lot of times people who come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct have to face that scrutiny and doubt. And that's so difficult because there's already trauma that they're going through and handling in addition to that questioning that's occurring from others. And I just will say, you know, throughout this journey, we've taken dozens of depositions and talked to countless witnesses and reviewed hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. And just coming to this resolution has really been healing and given our clients a sense of closure that their voices have been heard and that coming forward was not for nothing.
Kelly, how do you reflect on the more than 3 years of work?
Yeah, I mean, I just echo what Michaela had said. I think this has been a really challenging process for our clients, but one that I think ultimately they feel a sense of validation and recognition for speaking up now that we've been able to reach this resolution. We're just really grateful to be able to provide that closure to our clients.
What did the both of you learn during this process? I mean, you've had really intimate conversations with 80 people. Kelly?
You know, it's we've learned a lot about our clients. We've gotten very close to our clients. We've learned the far and deep reach that sexual abuse can have on the individual, and the unique ways in which trauma can manifest in our clients. I think that is really the thing that resonates the most for me is just how devastating the effect of sexual abuse can have on the individual.
You bring up an important point. Michaela, a settlement has been reached. It's undisclosed. But is this over? Can others still come forward? Or can criminal charges, are those even possible?
Yes, others still can come forward. And, you know, there is a statute of limitations that was extended in California in 2019, which allows someone to come forward within 10 years of the abuse. And then there was another statute of limitations revision that happened that allows adults who suffered from sexual abuse to come forward by the end of this year. So there's still time for others to come forward and speak their truth and make their voices heard.
Mm. How has this shaped you as an attorney, Michaela?
It has been a difficult journey. It's been a contentious litigation. But for me, I think the most rewarding part is helping our clients feel closure, but also holding the institutions accountable. A lot of times the institutions won't do anything unless there are lawsuits that are filed, unless there are people who come forward and questioning them, because that is what's going to drive change. And I think in this case, we did drive change, and that's really gratifying to everyone involved.
Mm. Kelly?
Yeah, I think it was just really rewarding to be able to be advocates for you know, people who really needed them and people whose stories needed to be told and shared in order to raise the profile that these kinds of things unfortunately do happen. And by raising that profile, we hope that this forces institutions like USC and others to reflect on the culture and the very policies that enable this type of conduct to occur.
Michaela touched upon this in terms of the kind of the legal strides that have made this possible. How big of a game changer was that, Kelly? Because I believe the statute of limitations previously was extended from 2 years to 10 years.
Right. And actually, one of the statutes that allowed a lot of our clients to proceed with their claims was a bill that was passed, AB 1510, which opened the statute of limitations for patients at a student health center like USC to bring their claims. It gave them a window to bring their claims. So, you know, when we're talking about statute of limitations in sex abuse cases, it's so important to recognize that the claimants here are people who have suffered trauma and who have repressed memories of what happened and on some level don't want to acknowledge that the worst has happened to them. And those people have a really hard time coming forward. So these legislations and statutes which provide these windows to come forward really are so important because a two-year window, frankly, just isn't enough.
Finally, what do the both of you want families and students to take away from this conversation? Michaela?
I think the biggest takeaway is that you're not alone. Right? If something has happened to you and you want to speak up and tell your truth, you will not be alone. There will be people there to support you and help you through it and help you find that closure. And I hope that people listening know that it's so important to share and amplify your voice about what had happened to you in order for you personally to heal, but also to give others the courage to come forward and share their truth.
Kelly, we have about 20 seconds left.
I agree with what Michaela said. It's important that survivors know that they're not alone and that there can be a lot of healing in holding wrongdoers accountable for what's happened to them.
Kelly and Michaela, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Michaela Kellogg and Kelly Van Aken are the attorneys who filed the original lawsuit against a former USC men's health physician accused of sexual abuse by 80 former students, the vast majority of whom identifies male and LGBTQ+. The settlement details are confidential, and both the university and the physician deny any wrongdoing. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The pandemic worsened food insecurity across the Sacramento region. Today, we're going to take a look at how these issues have impacted those directly responsible for bringing our food from farm to fork. People who harvest, process, ship, and prepare the food we eat are some of the most food insecure people in our region. Yolo County is a prime example of this cruel irony. In 2019, the gross value of the county's agricultural production was over $670 million. But food insecurity among farm workers in the county was nearly three times the national average, according to a 2016 study. In response, the Yolo Food Bank is launching Flipping the Food System to help nourish those who nourish our region and state and the world. Joining us now is Michael Bish, Executive Director for the Yolo Food Bank. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me. It's a real treat.
Yeah, it is a pleasure to have you. You're our first in-person guest. So
it's really exciting.
Well,
thank you.
Pop the champagne bottle later. What is so striking to me is that cruel juxtaposition that despite the enormous value Yolo County provides in agriculture, food insecurity was nearly three times the national average. What is the larger problem here, and what are the deeper issues?
Well, the larger problem here is that as a society, we're not ensuring that all of our basic needs are met for all community members. And I think that's where we really need to step up our game. And, you know, hopefully today with Big Day of Giving, the community is going to agree with that and is going to show the world.
So talk to us more about the initiative and what will flipping the food system, what does it actually look like? Help us visualize it.
Yeah, we're hoping to achieve three objectives with the initiative. The first is to really gain a a great understanding of the needs of these food system workers, because we don't really understand them right now. There's not been a lot of interaction with these community members about what their needs are, how they would like to have them met. Do they want direct deliveries? Do they want farmers market type food distributions? Do they want EBT cards? Do they want a combination of all of the above? We don't know any of that. And so we're going to be starting this effort with a series of listening sessions with these community members so that they can tell us what their needs are. The second thing is to draw community attention to this issue. I don't think most community members, when they go into a grocery store, are really conscious of the fact that the way the food arrived at that grocery store is through individuals whose own food security needs are not being met. And so we really want to rally the community around these needs. And then the third thing, of course, is to generate revenue so that we can fund the services that are going to be needed to provide this food assistance to these folks. So we're going for a trifecta here, and it's all happening today.
Yeah, you have said that food workers bear the brunt of an unjust food system. I mean, having that proximity but not having the means or the access to that food. Help us understand how the system is unjust and what solutions will make it more equitable.
Well, the system, there's multiple systems that are unjust, and it's all focusing these folks are bearing the brunt of that. So the housing system is unjust. The taxation system is unjust. The way we price labor is unjust. Transportation is unjust. I say unjust in the sense that all of these systems work great for the majority of the residents of the greater Sacramento region, but for the lower income folks, the lower wage earners, it's absolutely unjust. They simply can't afford what the rest of us, many of the rest of us, take for granted.
Yeah, it's financially hard to keep your head above water with those circumstances. And this follows a 2021 study just last year from the Public Policy Institute of California, which found Yolo County had the highest poverty rate in California at 20.9%. As an organization that works to reduce poverty and food insecurity, you're the Yolo Food Bank. Can you shed some light on why the poverty rate is higher in Yolo County than anywhere else in the state?
Well, part of it is we have a lot of students living in the county, so that's skewing that data somewhat. Yes, we do have plenty of low-income students at our community colleges as well as at UC Davis, but there's also a number of students that come from higher-income type families that still fall within that data. But even if you scrub the numbers of those individuals, the numbers are still way above the national average, and it's largely because we're an agricultural community, and these are quite often lower wage earners.
Given that food banks during the pandemic dealt with an exponential increase in the need, but also strained resources, now, what do you foresee as the biggest challenges that food banks face across the region, and how do you hope to overcome them in Yolo County?
Well, the biggest challenge by far is that much of the pandemic resources that went to food banks during the pandemic have gone away. So federal food supplies to food banks, not just in Yolo County or in the region, but across the state and across the nation, have declined by at least 25% over the course of the last year. Meanwhile, the need is increasing again because the federal support for low-income families has withered away as well. And so it's a huge challenge for food banks right now to procure enough food to distribute to meet the needs. And just to give you a sense, I mean, since January, already on top of this massive pandemic need, since January, the need has increased another 30% at Yolo Food Bank. So our lines are getting longer and longer. And meanwhile, the food supplies are not increasing. And so what we're having to do is we're having to dip into our financial reserves to purchase huge quantities of food to make up the gap that's left behind by the feds withdrawing from their pandemic response. I should also say the local jurisdictions have really their support has declined quite a bit as well.
I want to end with really your journey to the food bank, because you started in 2018. But before, you worked for the food bank and other nonprofits in Davis. You were an entrepreneur. You worked in mortgage lending, international corporate finance, all that stuff. What drew you to nonprofits, and what gets you excited and got you excited to join the Yolo Food Bank?
Well, my staff warned me that you might throw in a trick question, so I wasn't anticipating that. But in the lead up to me joining the food bank, I had been providing some advisory services to quite a few local nonprofits, and I saw some of the challenges that they were confronted with. And it seemed to me, in my background in the startup community and whatnot, that the nonprofit sector could really benefit from some for-profit type principles. And so I was fortunate to be offered the best job on planet Earth by my board of directors, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it's personal. You're human as well, and I can see it's emotional for you too.
Yep. Speaking of which, I'd love to give a shout out to my staff. Go YFB.
Go YFB, and you have the best job. How can we help? How can listeners who are listening want to help? What is the best way that they can help this in other programs at the food bank?
Well, if they're inspired by flipping the food system, they can definitely show it today on this unbelievable day that we call Big Day of Giving. So they can definitely go to bigdayofgiving.org/YOLOFoodbank for starters. They could also go to our webpage, yolofoodbank.org, and hit the volunteer button, because we're definitely always in need of volunteers, particularly as those lines get longer and longer, as I mentioned. And then for the large scale food distributors and whatnot, we would welcome your food donations, because it takes pallets and truckloads of food to meet the needs. I mean, this is not some small scale thing. This is happening on a massive scale. Just come to our distributions. You'll be inspired, and you'll want to support.
Well, we can hear it in your voice, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Bish is the executive director of the Yolo Food Bank. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.